Blog Talk Radio.
I am a young patriot, I struggle for right. Not for security alone do I fight, but the freedom to be whatever you might be. If we live in socialism and not slavery, I am a young patriot and I have a creed. I believe in others 'cause we have believed. Not in the rights of rulers, but humanity. To be healthy and happy and to be free. A young patriot, a term I define. Not a matter of age, but a state of mind. And if you love freedom for liberty, you care. Join the young patriots and fight for it there. Yeah, join the young patriots and fight for it there. Join the young patriots and fight for it there.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the fourth episode of When the World is on Fire. We got a really special episode tonight. We got Mel Figueroa and David Keith Cobb talking with us about Green Party politics, anti-fascism, and cooperatives. We're still looking for a sponsor for When the World is on Fire. It costs us about $39.99 a month, and we would very much appreciate to have somebody to sponsor this. And you can get in touch with us on our Facebook page, Young Patriots Birmingham. And at the Young Patriots Birmingham, Confessions of a Mad Redneck, or the Cooperative New School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice. So if you can get in touch with us online and let us know if you could possibly sponsor our podcast. We got some interesting stuff coming up in Birmingham. Tomorrow night we're having a film screening about couscous and Tunisia. As you remember, last month we had Mabruka Mubarak on talking about the Tunisian Revolution, and this documentary is about how couscous played a role in dignity and independence in the Tunisian Revolution. There's also some interesting stuff going on with me. My wife, Robin Hayden, was selected to be the executive director of Alabama Arise, which is a policy institute for the poor out of Montgomery. I'm going to be moving out of Birmingham. We're going to be moving into Montgomery. I'm really, really super proud of my wife. She's 31 years old. She's one of the most capable people that I know. She's really got her act together, and I'm really excited and impressed with her, and excited about our future. So hi, any news to tell us about Young Patriots or anything that you're doing?
Yeah, I just got an email today from a group in Chicago that we've been working with called the Healing Corner. And what that is about is I was up there last summer and had a chance to get together with some of these folks and the Young Patriots, and we actually went into some of the gang neighborhoods and you know, some of the areas where they've had a lot of gang violence and police violence and, you know, killings. And we actually set up on a street corner and bring out music and artists and games for kids. And, you know, we bring literature and we get the people out of their buildings to start talking about, you know, how they can be involved in the, you know, the betterment of their community. And we get a chance to talk to some of the gang members too about, you know, what's going on. And it's had some very positive effects. And so they want to start funding some programs here in Alabama, you know, in Huntsville and Birmingham and Montgomery and those places where, you know, there might be, you know, some gang violence or police violence, and, you know, and getting people more involved in, you know, the self-determination of their neighborhood. So that's something that's very exciting that I'm going to be, you know, talking to people about, you know. And so I think, you know, I think it might just work out, you know. So that's a major project that I'm going to be introducing pretty soon.
Cool. Thank you for that. And so on the line we have David Keith Cobb. David, how are you doing? Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? What type of projects you're involved in, and you know, maybe a little bit about your politics?
Well, sure. Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. I gotta say it is good to talk to a leftist who don't talk funny, Zach. I often use that joke, but it's normally because I'm the one who talks like this in these kind of circles. So I'm looking forward to the conversation. I grew up in rural Texas. I have learned not to be ashamed to actually say I grew up in grinding poverty. And I know that rural poverty is different than urban poverty, but poor people, being poor sucks. And, you know, I used to be embarrassed about that, but now that I have come to understand how capitalism works and how the systems itself work, I realize it wasn't my parents' fault at all, wasn't my fault at all, but it was, in fact, the system that was the problem. From there, I went on to work in construction for several years, finally made my way to college and then ultimately law school, worked as a public interest and a personal injury trial lawyer for several years, then got involved in Green Party work. And I say in all interviews, not just this one, that I'm a revolutionary because I believe we have to restructure this society. We need new social, political, and economic institutions, and I'm looking forward to diving in what that means and how we can actually go about doing that.
Great, David, and it is nice to have somebody who doesn't talk funny who's in a leftist circle. I think you're right at home on this podcast in saying that that you're a revolutionary and that your goal is the complete restructuring of social, political, and economic institutions. And I'm especially interested to hear about how the Green Party plays into that goal. You know, I don't know if people know a little bit about the Green Party, but it's a third party that gets a few percent of the electoral vote in the presidential election. They actually had a mayor in Richmond, California, that instituted a cooperative economy, which I'd like to talk about later. So, David, what do you think is the role of the Green Party in bringing about the restructuring of social, economic, and political institutions?
Well, Zach, here's how I say it. That if one reads U.S. history specifically, I mean world history I think as well, but specifically U.S. history, and you say, what does it take? What is the recipe for systemic changes that have been made? I don't mean just tinkering at the margins, but the times that there have been really systemic changes in the system. What you'll find is that the recipe is actually very simple, and it's actually simple to say, but super hard to implement. Number one, there have always systemic social change always requires a mass movement, and I mean a whole bunch of people involved at pool halls, bowling alleys, barbershops, beauty parlors, everywhere where people are the movement has to be happening. And that movement has to be both broad but also deep, conscious, and educated. So just to say a mass movement is already books and books, right? But number one, a mass movement. But number two, it also requires an electoral arm to actually engage electoral politics in some sort of way in order to implement the program and to force the legal changes that those systemic demands would make. So a systemic change has always required both a social movement and an electoral arm working in tandem. And although that's very easy to say, historically it's proven incredibly difficult to do.
Great. And we have Mel Figueroa on the line right now. Hi, Mel. How are you doing?
Great. Great to have you on, and great to talk to you again, David.
So we're sort of chatting with David about Green Party politics, and we already asked him, you know, what type of work he was involved in, and I want to go ahead and give you an opportunity to advertise whatever type of work that you're doing and let us know what you're doing too, and then we can get back to the conversation.
Okay. So I'm a PhD candidate in geography at UC Berkeley. That was my role both before and after. I served as the national press director for the Stein-Baraka campaign in 2016. Since then, I, as I'm sure David has mentioned, been doing the Movement School for Revolutionaries. But David, I've just completed a 10,000-mile tour around the United States in my car, in my van, to talk to different communities and also to learn about different communities. Where I'm going next is, basically, I'm also a member of the steering committee of the Campus Anti-Fascist Network, which formed in 2017 during the wave of attacks on college campuses that is ongoing. And, I'm working to expand and deepen a broad, united front of very, all different organizations and people who are committed to and know sort of what time it is, right? What that in this time of uncertainty, radical uncertainty, and also of, I think quite acute danger, we need to be working together and we need to be coordinated and we need to be bold about a different version of the vision of the world that we want to advance, because those forces on the right are advancing their vision of the world. And so, I think it's up to all of us, and all of us need to be empowered to be able to make the changes that we need.
Great. Thank you for that. So let's dive right into Green Party politics in the 2016 campaign. A lot of people would say that third party politics are a waste of time, that they don't accomplish anything. And I think Mel has mentioned to me that in some states, if you don't have a Green Party candidate at the top of the ticket, you can't get Green Party candidates at lower down on the ticket. So my question for you is, what was gained and what was accomplished during the 2016 campaign in terms of the Green Party?
Well, maybe I'll jump in and give a big, big picture and then ask Mel to get a little more specific. Because one thing, Zach, I want to do is circle back to the important role that alternative political parties have, in fact, played throughout history. Because I'm going to give you a quick list of the things that it took third parties, so-called third parties, what I'll call alternative political parties, to actually champion at the ballot box. Here's that list: the abolition of slavery, women getting the right to vote, the creation of the Social Security Administration, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation laws, pure food and drug laws, ending child labor, the direct election of the United States Senate, the entire regimen of worker protection laws, that the entire fabric of what we today consider at least a bare damn minimum for a decent society was literally woven together by so-called third-party activists who did their work when they were called naive and unrealistic, third-party activists who did their work when they were called dangerous un-Americans, and third-party work activists who did their work when they were called spoilers. So today, if we actually think that we can live in a different world and restructure society, if we want to end war as foreign policy, if we want to transition to
genuine, sustainable economic activity, if we want to move the society away from the growing inequality and to a socialist economy, we're going to have to come to terms with the fact that it's going to have to include a different kind of electoral politics. I know that's big picture, and you had asked about 2016 and what was accomplished. I could go deeper there, but I want to turn it over to my colleague and comrade Mel and give her a crack at that.
Yeah. To me, I think the seeming chaos of the 2016 election was, you know, what we call a conjuncture moment. It's that moment when things really start to crack. You know, of course, there have been many cracks in the system developing over a long period of time, but it's where the ruptures actually started to ripple throughout society up to the very top. And we saw that happening in the primary season, not just with, you know, Trump and that chaos of the Republican, that Republican Party became, but also with the rise of the Bernie Sanders movement. And when I say Bernie Sanders movement, I'm not actually talking about the man, Bernie Sanders. What he did contribute was to articulate, again, what I was saying earlier about visions of the world, an alternative vision to an untenable status quo. And when I say, but when I say the movement, I mean this generation, the masses of people that actually woke up and started to, you know, fight for a non-monstrous vision of the world. You know, I was actually not even in the country at the time. I was in Brazil, but I was watching this phenomenon, you know, grow and flourish and exceed everyone's expectations in terms of how it succeeded in the political arena. As I've said to David several times, and I say it all the time, you know, if it wasn't 2016, if it wasn't the particular moment in time that that was, Bernie Sanders could have been like Denis Kucinich or any other of the progressive candidates that have challenged the establishment during the primaries. They could have gotten a few percent, gone home, started at some kind of organization or whatever. And this alternative narrative, this narrative of something that was possible and something that was you know, at least more just than the world that neoliberalism had left so many people in, especially young people, but not all, you know, that vision, especially when it looked like, you know, Bernie being crushed by the undemocratic and, you know, actions of the DNC in the primary cycle, you know, the movement that came up around that narrative is, you know, was stronger, self-organized, and even more widespread than any of us could have ever imagined. And so that, I mean, that's why I actually, a week after I got home from my dissertation fieldwork, I joined the Stein campaign, because I knew that somebody and some, you know, in somebody had to carry on that narrative and that vision of the world in this particular arena of electoral politics, what, you know, still most Americans consider to be the realm of politics, although, you know, those of us who have been working in the streets know that, you know, it's far beyond that. But that's why I decided to get into, shall we say, the game, you know, at that point. And, you know, it is still going strong. There are so many thousands and millions of people that I have met all over this country who are still willing to fight for that vision. And, you know, as I've said recently, you know, I'm sort of in the last few years of Generation X. Everyone younger than me is fighting for their lives. Everyone who's alive now is fighting to have a future, to, you know, period. And that, you know, this, but that moment, that particular moment in time of the 2016 election was the time when really the facade came down, the illusions, all of our illusions that have lulled so many people to sleep for so many years just started breaking down. And, you know, this is the moment that we have to grab. We have to catch this momentum and run with it, because if we don't, other people will, and you've already seen that.
Great. Thank you. Thank both of you. That's very interesting. So we've talked about the Green Party and the role in the 2016 election and what was happening in the 2016 election. It's all really great information. But what does the Green Party stand for? I think some of the listeners may not know exactly what the Green Party is and what does it stand for. So if one or both of you could let us know, what are the central tenets to the Green Party platform?
Well, I'll start out with the four pillars of the International Green Party movement. David, if you do the 10 keys, I haven't memorized all of them, but I'll start off with the four pillars. The four pillars are peace, democracy, ecology, and justice. And, you know, those encompass so many different issues, but really what it expresses are the foundations of the better world that we want to build. David?
And Zach, what I would say is that those four pillars are the international core beliefs of the global Green Party movement, which makes us unique because we are at this moment really the only true global connected political party. And the platform of the Green Party of the United States can be found at gp.org. But what you'll find is very concrete, specific policy proposals that, if implemented, would reflect the core values of those four pillars that Mel just articulated. And what I would say is this: the big policy positions that Jill Stein ran on and that Greens everywhere are running on is, number one, an awareness that the ecological collapse is not coming. It's here and beginning, and we have got to transition away from the fossil fuel use and energy production modes to sustainable energy practices. Number two, the end to war and wars of empire and theft of resources of other folks. Number three, the implementation of a legal system for both health care and education as fundamental human rights. And of course, if you have the right to something, it means that the society itself has to provide them. So we go beyond the idea of some sort of reforms to say we need an entirely new orientation to make human rights codified under law. And of course, this would also include the idea of the Green New Deal, in order to do that, to put ordinary people to work in meaningful, productive ways to recreate the society that we want. And I want to say very bluntly, Zach and Hi, and every one of y'all's listeners, the reality is that world is possible. It's not being implemented because we don't have a functioning democracy. What we have is a genuine oligarchy, or what I sometimes call a kleptocracy. We got to rule not just by a small ruling elite, but a small thieving elite, and unless and until we come to terms with the fact that we don't have a functioning democracy, I don't know how we can actually not only get through it, but how we can actually survive it. We're going to have a peaceful revolution, and that's what the Green Party aspires to do.
Great. Thank you very much. I would have to say that of all the political parties that I've ever heard of, the Green Party sounds like the best one to me. I'm kind of an autonomous in terms of political ideology. I'm not sure how much I believe in political parties, but yeah, the Green Party is the best of the bunch. I can say for sure. I think one thing that has sort of been alluded to sort of obliquely by the both of you is the rise of fascism in the United States and across the globe. And I want to talk to you, and there's been some talk about Antifa, and they get a lot of press in terms of their more confrontational, more violent approaches to deplatforming fascism. But I think there are a lot of other strategies for undercutting the organizing of fascists. And I was wondering if the two of you could talk about what some of those strategies for undermining the organizing of fascism could be.
Well, Mel, you've got to take this one because this is
as a matter of fact, this month, the Green Party of the United States will be voting on a proposed resolution that has been forwarded to the National Committee by the Green Party of California that, you know, basically will hopefully, if it passes, will make the Green Party the first national political party to take an explicitly anti-fascist stance. So that we will be an explicitly anti-fascist party. Now, it's been very interesting because, you know, especially with the sort of notoriety of Antifa and, you know, some of these more sort of, shall we say, contentious confrontational moments, you know, one of the things that has been, you know, a point of debate amongst all manner of activists, including the Green Party, is the, you know, the issue of course, violence, nonviolence, and, you know, and where we kind of were thinking around this was, you know, if the four pillars of the Green Party are peace, justice, ecology, and democracy, you know, many people take peace to mean, you know, sort of that kind of nonviolence, sort of absolute nonviolent stance. But, you know, when we're in a time of rising fascism, when we are in a time when stormtroopers are, you know, like literally raining down violence more than ever before in our society, I think the statistic was that white supremacists killed more and fascist groups killed more people in 2017 than any other extremist group, you know, operating in the United States. This is where the sort of these two pillars of peace and justice have to find some kind of resolution. And, you know, having been at Berkeley and having been sort of in the crosshairs, literally, of the sort of the surge of the stormtroopers, the Proud Boys, you know, and these various groups that have been attacking college campuses, you know, I've done a lot of thinking and organizing around this, and we've come up with what I like to call four things you can do to fight fascism without punching a Nazi. I mean, of course, like sort of defense, you know, self-defense, community self-defense, and sort of street confrontations are one thing, but really where the battle against fascism is won is in the hearts and minds of communities and in our everyday life. And, you know, really what it means to be a decent human being in the face of such brutality. And so the four sort of the four main points of the four things you can do is, number one, on baseline, show up and protect your community. One of the things I learned from, you know, our experience at Berkeley was, you know, when it was just small groups confronting each other in the street, you know, people still weren't safe. People weren't safe at all. It was only when the whole community came together as a community to say, we are going to, you know, protect and defend and respect every single member of our community. It was when businesses refused service to fascist groups who wanted to, you know, sit and organize in their, you know, eating establishments. It was when people were organizing escorts to, you know, help targeted people so that they wouldn't be walking alone at, you know, at night. I mean, that kind of, you know, sort of broad community defense was really what helped us win that battle. Number two is, you know, and part of it is also a battle over the narrative. It is what is being portrayed in the media. It is what is the story that people understand about this moment in time and these groups. And so many times, you know, even the media that, you know, that expresses horror at some of these actions, they're still amplifying the voices of the fascists, right? This is one of the reasons why free speech became, and not the actual violence that was being unleashed on people, was the main story. So number two is lift up the voices of the vulnerable. If it really is about free speech, we should be hearing the speech of the people who are targeted by the fascists, not just the story the way the fascists tell it. And that brings us to number three, which is shift the narrative about fascism. You know, if it is merely about free speech, then, you know, why is it that, you know, those of us who were targeted by the fascists could not even get a hearing in the mainstream media? We need to speak out about fascism. We need to reinforce the message that everyone on this earth has the right to life, dignity, and protection from racist violence. We need to engage critically with fellow activists, even on the technical differences, but that shouldn't stop us from the main point, which is fascism is bad. You know, if Antifa, which is short for anti-fascist, becomes a bad word and is demonized, who benefits from that? Only fascists benefit from that, right? And encourage people to remember this proud tradition of decent human beings who resisted the horrors of fascism, everyone from Albert Einstein, George Orwell, Anne Frank, you know, all of these people who resisted in many different ways, not just violently, but in terms of upholding just decent human values. And which, of course, leads us to number four, which is not to appeal to what the status quo is. You know, if we only, if we self-censor ourselves, if we shape our actions to appease a society that is at its core white supremacist, you know, misogynist, imperialist, and, you know, classist and capitalist, then, you know, then we're done, right? The point is to change it. The point is to create a society that leaves no one behind. Because as we're seeing right now with the immigrants who and the families that are being separated by ICE, you know, if we don't care about one community, they're going to come for the next one and the next one. That's what that poem is all about. The first they came for the communists, then they came for the immigrants. You know, that is happening right now. And so, you know, again, people are being thrown away and swept under the rug because we live in a society that has these implicit biases, prejudices, and divisions within it. And so in order for us to truly beat fascism, we need to create a just, sustainable, and equitable world in which, you know, fascist movements have no room to grow and ultimately no room to even exist.
Great. Thank you for that. Did you want to respond to this, David, or do you want to go ahead and move on to the next question?
Well, let's move on to the next question because there's okay. I know we've got limited time, and I thought Mel really did a great job there.
Okay. Why now? Why is fascism rising now? And I think there, it's been alluded to a couple of times that we're in sort of a unique time in our country and in the world. And, you know, fascism is sort of latent in our culture and in our society. And why is organized fascism rising now?
So, you know, let me take a crack at that one, Zach. I really appreciate that you described it as organized fascism, because remember that, you know, totalitarianism and, the kind of Nazis marching around have always existed. But actual fascism is actually a theory of how to organize society. And actual fascism requires a social movement. And that's what we're actually seeing now is an attempt to actually organize a social movement along fascist tendencies. And remember that the fascists themselves would say, look, we want an ordered society. We want to ensure that working people have the ability to get the fruits of their labor. And it is really about the ethno-state, right? And I think that this is something that we really have to understand. Fascism is rising now for the same reasons that fascism was on the rise in the 1930s, because society was being restructured in the 30s from an agrarian society to an industrial one. And now what we understand is industrialism is coming to an end. And what's really scary is capitalism itself is coming to an end. The whole way of organized society on capitalist principles based upon the private ownership of things that, and then the sale of those items for money is going to have to end, because we're entering into an era of robotics and automation that are such that that literally the ruling class and the owning class literally don't even need workers at the level that they once did. So society is going to be reorganized.
And I believe sincerely and bluntly, it's either going to be organized around socialist basic principles or fascist basic principles. And the reason the fascism is arising now is because the current systems are failing, and people know that they're failing, even if they don't actually understand why they're failing.
Mel?
Yeah, I mean, David summarized it really well. I mean, I think the only things I would add is, you know, to really emphasize the economic sort of factor in here. You know, this rising right-wing, you know, tendencies, rising fascism, it's not just happening here. It's happening all over the industrialized world, in Europe, in even in places in the emerging economies like India and South Africa. And this is because, you know, since 2008, capitalism has been continuously in crisis since 2008, no matter what the business press is going to tell you. You know, even though the stock market may be soaring, we all know that for the average person, it's getting harder and harder and harder every single day. And, you know, desperate people are going to look for desperate answers. When the status quo cannot hold, when the status quo can no longer provide for people, and not just that, now that austerity measures have been absolutely devastating communities from here to Greece, you know, you have all of these people that have lost faith in the system as it stands. I mean, there's those of us that lost faith a long time ago, but now the average person, like, no longer has any faith in either our governmental or economic systems to save us. And so, you know, I mean, it's desperate people will take anything for an answer, especially if what I like to say is that, you know, when Rosa Luxemburg said that we stand at the crossroads between socialism and barbarism, socialism, I think, is the type of radical answer that reflects the best of humanity, and fascism is the type of radical answer that emphasizes the worst. And so, you know, this is where we're at right now. And again, it's a crossroads between two choices. Which world are we going to choose?
And if I could just add on or really underscore part of what Mel pointed out, and that is that the global fascist response to capitalism's late stage and the decay is happening in countries that are not white, as well as in European or white places, right? India, South Africa, in many places in the global South, you're seeing examples of ethnostates that are actually from brown and black pigmented people. The point is that it's not peculiar to whiteness, or and white supremacy is real, and we can deconstruct that. But a core understanding of fascism is the creation of an ethnostate, and that can happen anywhere.
It's really, really interesting stuff. I think it's, you know, you talk about people losing faith in institutions, and I think people in the American South lost faith in institutions many, many years ago, and I think there's lessons to be learned from organizing in the American South in terms of, you know, how do we get people who are in difficult circumstances to believe in each other and believe in a better future. And, you know, I'm biased about the South, but I think I think there's a lot of hope here. I know that
say this.
Go ahead.
And quote one of my mentors, Jerome Scott, who founded Project South: as goes the South, so goes the nation. You know, the Highlander is hallowed ground for me. And I am with you 100% that if we don't actually learn the lessons from both the things that worked well and the tragic mistakes that were made in the South, we are in deep trouble. So thank you for saying that.
And I want to put my two cents in, lest people think that you two are biased from being from the South. I can say from my, you know, California coastal background that my favorite place in going through the nation this past year was the South, and I'm really looking forward to coming back. There's so much going on there, and I found so much more hope than I ever could have expected. So
Yeah, we're pretty cool. I know that David is part of Cooperation Humboldt, and we've organized a number of cooperatives here in Birmingham. We have a whole network of cooperative institutions, and cooperatives are sort of an oldie but a goodie. You know, it's an old strategy, but it's a strategy that seems to consistently work. And the question I have is, like, in the context of this conversation, how do cooperatives work to fight fascism? And at the same time, what is it that cooperatives are and do that make them such an effective tool for fighting for dignity and justice?
So let me take a first crack at this one, Zach, because it's a deep question, but I'm gonna hit it quickly and say this. Cooperatives, of course, are ways for people to get their needs met without exploitation and oppression. In a nutshell, they are a new way of doing economic activity that is actually honoring work rather than exploiting labor, right? So very plain and simple, a true worker cooperative might be revolutionary, but it could also just be something that people are doing that are better than other things. What makes, and I'll say with candor and also humility, what makes Cooperation Humboldt different is we say straight up that we know that cooperatives are not the answer, but they are part of the answer. And we are very clear that we are revolutionaries that are intent upon completely restructuring society, not just the individual co-op that we're incubating are part of. So I guess what I would say is ultimately I don't want to be part of just having an expanded little niche of cooperative economics. I actually want the cooperative culture that a worker co-op represents to be the norm, not the alternative. And again, I could go deeper, but I wanted to give that big picture overview.
Oh, and that is the kicker. The cooperative culture is the kicker because, you know, you can get worker owners in a cooperative, but getting them to adopt the cooperative culture is a very deep struggle because we're not socialized to think in terms of that. We're socialized to think in terms of how do I maximize my own gain, you know, really in the short term, and which is a cooperative culture, a revolutionary cooperative culture is the exact opposite, which is how do I maximize my community's gain in the long term, and how do we provide for the needs that the community has. And, this socialization, this individualistic socialization is so deeply rooted that even the most progressive people can struggle with being able to adopt the cooperative culture. And I include myself in that because I'm in two cooperatives myself. And, you know, I have to constantly check myself to make sure that, you know, I'm abiding by the right cultural principles.
You know, what's very interesting is that, you know, for millennia, before maybe just about 500 years ago, most of humanity, if not all, were organized in at least some kind of collective fashion. Even if it wasn't equal, it was, you know, there was a sense of, you know, that people had a role to play and it all worked together. I think people forget that this idea of the atomized human, that you do it all by yourself, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps or whatever, is a relatively new idea in history. And that, you know, poor, oppressed, and impoverished people all over the world, can and still use the culture of cooperation to survive. Actually, last night I was, since the tragic death of Anthony Bourdain, I've kind of been binge watching episodes of his shows every time I get some free time. And last night, I think for the first time, I watched his episode on West Virginia, which again it's always been a place that fascinated me. I went through it this just a few months ago, and I was so moved. Also by the way that he portrayed the place, you know, exploded so many of the myths and stereotypes that people have about it. But one of the things that really struck me were like these, you know, dirt poor towns, but that had this culture already of cooperation built in, this idea that, you know, everybody looks out for one another. The fact that you can go, if you didn't have anything to eat, you can go to a neighbor's place and like have them fix you, you know, they'll fix you a sandwich, or, you know, the farmers were getting together and, you know, creating food banks to feed people who didn't have money to for anything to eat. So, you know, the culture of cooperation is all around us. It's just something we've forgotten. And, you know, I think that for me, that's where hope lies, is that, you know, cooperation is as built into our social and, you know, species being, shall we say, as, you know, competition. And in fact, that's how many species actually have found ways to survive. And so, you know, I think that cooperatives are, you know, ways of simply facilitating, institutionalizing and cultivating that instinct that we all have as social beings, and the recognition that we all need each other, and we all value each other, and we must in order to survive.
David, did you want to dive a little bit deeper into the cooperative culture and possibly how cooperatives can counteract fascism? Did you want to dive a little deeper into that?
Well, thank you for the invitation, and I will do it. And I'll take it from where sort of Mel left off here, because I think it's important that we actually acknowledge that actually it is in fact in our DNA. Anthropologists and those who study such things tell us that human beings, Homo sapiens, literally would not have survived as a species if we were not cooperators. We are a collective species. There's just no doubt about it. We can't survive except for with each other. We are literally not just dependent, but we're interdependent. Here's something else that science is teaching us, and that is that for 99% of us, if we see another human being in acute distress and then assist or alleviate that acute distress, the actor, the person who did the solid, gets a dopamine shot of pleasure. That's true for 99% of us. We are hardwired to actually literally get physical pleasure out of helping other people. Now, there's a problem with the 1%, right? I mean, and the problem is that the 99% of us are going to, given the opportunity to cooperate, but we have created a society in which we are literally incentivizing and rewarding the absolute worst aspects of our species. So I think that this is something that's really important to not just counteract the influence of our current culture, but to actually name the fact that it's actually anti-human. It's actually against our own nature. Now, I don't believe that human beings are either angelic nor demonic. I think that most of us are going to do the things that we are incentivized to do. And our problem is that we have created social, political, and economic institutions that incentivize exploitation and oppression. So what is important to me around a cooperative venture, especially the difference between a worker co-op and a consumer co-op, is to actually ground that culture into it. And as you've described, Zach, to struggle with that every day to counteract our enculturation. Really what we're talking about is decolonizing our minds. We're talking about not just decolonizing the territory of the United States that was, of course, colonized through white supremacy and empire and genocide, but decolonize our own minds about not only what is possible, but what is the good life itself, right? You know, you talked about, you know, the hyper-individualism. Actually, I think that the part of the problem is that it's a lie. So one of the ways that we at Cooperation Humboldt are trying to do that is to say, we have program areas, we have projects that are external, and then we have internal political education and culture shifting work. Here's what I mean by that. So we have broken down the things that we believe that people need to not only survive and thrive, but to have a really niche and meaningful life. And that includes food, shelter, art and culture,
health care, child care, and education. So those are our program areas. And under each program area, we are surveying our community to say what already exists that's moving in the right direction. Almost nothing is moving exactly where we want, but almost every one of our program areas, we can find things to support, lift up, and say thumbs up. So we're trying to network the things that are already happening into a more coherent strategy. But we're also trying to say, where are the gaps? Where are the ways, where are the value adds that we can do right now to begin to facilitate that sort of shift? And we're doing that. But the last thing that I really want to underscore here is our commitment to internal self-education. So we have a requirement that if you're going to be on the core team, you've got to voluntarily participate in a every 2 week 90-minute session where we facilitate different readings. And there's usually only 10 to 15 pages, but where we really go deep on what is happening in this historic moment. What is the dance and play between ecology and economics? You know, and if you go to our website under resources, you'll see the kind of reading list that we do. But the point is we are developing a very strong shared political analysis, creating the space where genuine debate and disagreement is not only allowed but encouraged, as long as it's done respectfully and in a comradely way. And we are building the kind, let's call it social solidarity and social cohesion that's going to be necessary to actually shift the whole thing. Because here's my point. When I said that fascism required a social movement, and Nell pointed out that it's either going to be socialism or fascism, you know, or socialism or barbarism, as Rosa Luxemburg said, there's no doubt in my mind as things continue to fail, regular folk are going to look around and they're going to break one way or the other. And if they see people living in a cooperative manner that is actually jumping and joyous and getting their needs met and they're actually happy about it, then most people are going to follow along that way in any given community. And if all they see are folks go in the other direction, then that's the direction that they're likely to go. So when I say that the cooperative movement can actually counter fascism, it's not merely a theoretical orientation, because we have to actually meet people's needs. We actually have to provide tangible benefits that actually show people not only that your needs can be met, but that you're going to have a great life by coming and fooling with us.
That's awesome. So I asked this, I asked the last question, and I asked it to everybody. And I guess one of you could answer, or both of you, I don't know. We have about 5 minutes left. So, what is your hope for the future? What is your hope and vision for the future?
Hit it, Mal.
Well, my my hopeful future vision is that this crisis actually is an opportunity for people to do what they kind of know is needed, which is to stand up for each other, to do for each other, and to sort of throw off so many of the illusions that keep us working, you know, so many jobs for, I mean, so many hours in, you know, jobs that we don't benefit from. That, I mean, you know, honestly, for me, the two things that, like, I go by is just logic and respect. And, you know, there's so many people that know this is wrong. There's so many people that know that we can do better. And, you know, I think all we have to do now is to just do better. And, you know, we're hoping to have that. You know, part of what we're trying to do also is to, again, just like Cooperation Humboldt, foster these local initiatives so that communities all over, you know, the country, as is already happening all over the world, are realizing not only that, you know, self-sufficiency is necessary, but that it is also possible. You know, if we think about our day-to-day lives, you know, how many times do we really interact with Donald Trump? No time, right? I mean, he's not at the store. He's not selling us food. He's not delivering you know, cable service, right? It's all of us that are already doing it. We just, you know, there's just that class up there that controls the means and, you know, takes the benefit. And if people can just realize that, you know, we can keep doing, we keep doing for each other and not for the, you know, 1% at the top, we can really make this world a beautiful place. So that's it for me.
That's beautiful.
So
I want to, go ahead.
What I hope people do is go to and learn more about the Cooperative New School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice. And I know, Zach, that that's part of what you're doing, and I know my dear friend and comrade Mel is starting to do it, but I want to give an unsolicited advertisement for the cooperativenewschool.com. This is a place I think is the future of where organizing, social change, and actual just deep thinking around theory and practice can actually land. So, folks, please join me in helping to support the Cooperative New School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice at cooperativenewschool.com.
Awesome. Thank you very much. I say that I do this because I get to corner people that I respect and admire and ask them a bunch of prying questions for about an hour. And it's a lot of times people who don't really have the time to do it, but they do it anyway. And I really appreciate both of you coming on. I respect and admire both of you very, very deeply. And I appreciate you answering the questions. And I appreciate you giving the audience an opportunity to understand what y'all are all about. And, you know, it really is about human dignity. And I hope everybody enjoyed it. Get in touch with us on the Cooperative New School Facebook page, Confessions of a Mad Redneck, or Young Patriots Organization Birmingham Facebook page. Do y'all have any, we got about a minute left. Y'all have any things that y'all want to advertise right before we sign off?
Sure. So just to give out our website again for the movement School for Revolutionaries, it is at School4Rev.org. We are also on Facebook at facebook.com/School4Rev. We also, those of you who are listening in California, we are doing a movement school this Saturday in Chico. So come if you are in the area of North Central California, come up and check us out.
And we'll be in Nevada County, California, and then in Eureka, California. So we're everywhere. And if you were intrigued by hearing about Cooperation Humboldt, our website is cleverly named cooperationhumboldt.org.
All right. Thanks a lot, y'all. And we're going to sign off with the Young Patriot song.
All right. Thanks so much for watching.
Thank you.
Yep.
Good night.
Good night.
Young patriot, I struggle for right, not for security alone do I fight, but the freedom to be whatever you might be. If we live in socialism and not slavery, I am a young patriot and I have a creed. I believe in others 'cause we have believed. Not in the rights of rulers, but humanity. To be healthy and happy and to be free. Young patriot, a term I define, not a matter of age, but a state of mind. And if you love freedom for liberty, you care. Join the young patriots and fight for it there.
Yeah, join the young patriots and fight for it there. Join the young patriots and fight for it there.